Welcome everybody to another episode of the Weekly Devs Brew. I'm here today with Daniel Ehrenberg, and we are going to talk about the TC39 and the evolution of JavaScript. Hi Daniel, how are you doing today?
Hi Jan-Niklas, very, very well, thank you for inviting me.
Anytime, this is great. One thing that I'm always wondering with the TC39 is like, I love the work that you put into, I always see the meeting notes and there's so much going on, but I feel like the meeting notes are kind of like happening at the end, and I wish there was like some more transparency. So how is the process going for some people that are not as involved as you are?
Okay, well, we always publish our agendas before the meetings as well. So okay. If you're interested in giving input, it would be really good not to wait until the end, but earlier in the process, for each agenda item, there's linked the repository where each proposal is developed, and you can go there, read it, file issues with your feedback. You know, any feedback is really useful, and if it comes before the meeting, then it can also be integrated. The other thing is that in TC39, we have our stage process, where it's not like we just discuss something once and it gets added to the language. There's a lot more to consensus building. You know, we have to convince all kinds of different parties that something is a good idea and refine it based on input from all of them.
Right.
So we start with stage one, where something is kind of on the table, it's an idea. Then stage two, we agree that we want to eventually do it, but it still is, you know, we have a concrete draft, but there's still some things to work out. In stage 2.7, which is a new stage idea, number that's in the middle, we have a very complete draft of all the details that we've agreed on as the committee, but we still may have to work out tests. So we have conformance tests that we put in a repository called test262. It's named that because the JavaScript specification, ECMAScript specification, is called ECMA262, hence test262. Once you have those tests and integration with other relevant platforms like the web designed, then it's at stage three.
Gotcha.
And then once there are multiple implementations, it can become stage four, and it's part of the standard.
With multiple implementation, you mean multiple browsers have implemented, and it's basically good to go as long as you're on a modern browser.
Yeah, I mean, we also care about other implementations, you know, there's like QuickJS, sometimes Babel or polyfills are relevant, but we also, at the same time, hold, you know, multiple browsers as a minimum bar currently for anything to get there. I think if you want to figure out what's usable in browsers, the baseline specification from MDN is good.
Yeah,
that has, when something is already implemented in three browsers, in all of them, then it can be in the, I forgot what they called it, the kind of beta baseline. And then that's, you know, been in place for a couple of years, it's fully part of baseline. So we, for the annual versions, you know, we have ES 2024 or 2025. Those are based on what's at stage four, which is a somewhat lesser requirement because it only requires the two.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that makes sense. So the way you described it, it sounds like I can now just go to the TC39 GitHub repository and file a proposal for some idea that I think makes sense for JavaScript.
Well, if you want to propose a new proposal, we have a discourse instance.
Okay.
So you go to es.discourse.group, and you can create a thread for one of those.
You're saying discourse, not Discord, right?
Yeah, discourse, like the forum software.
Okay. Gotcha.
And that's the best way to file new ideas. I think it's often best to contribute to an existing proposal because, you know, if you think about something that you're trying to get done, probably other people are also interested in it.
Yeah.
Then you can kind of ally with them. They can provide support. The people who are leading the proposal can probably find tasks for you that are useful because there's always more to do than people have time for.
Okay.
People don't always realize that sometimes proposals get blocked up, not because there's any kind of opposition or controversy, just because nobody's kind of worked through some aspect of it.
I can see that. JavaScript as a language is known for a high quality standard in terms of backwards compatibility. It's like basically never break anything that already works.
Yeah.
Has that been a problem to some extent? Because I imagine it's difficult to handle.
really doesn't end up being that much of a problem most of the time. Most of the time, if you're just trying to add something, there's no reason to consider breaking backwards compatibility.
Makes sense.
You know, sometimes it can be tricky because what is a compatibility risk is a little bit subtle and ambiguous. For example, we've found that adding methods to the array class often causes, you know, breakages.
In what way?
Well, sometimes libraries have conditionals in them that go like, if a method called array prototype, you know, contains, exists, then use it and expect to do this. Otherwise, fill in my polyfill.
Yeah.
And so that's why we had to rename array prototype contains to array prototype includes. But in general, it's kind of an empirical thing.
Yeah.
You try to change. If you encounter breakage, then you try something else. Of course.
How do you encounter those breakages? Because, I mean, like, I don't expect you to have, like, running tests against every major library that is out there.
Yeah.
How does that work?
It's a little impractical. I mean, we should establish more like this. You know, Node.js has a has a CI system for this. Yeah. But for the web, you know, browsers have their staged rollout with, for example, Chrome's process where they have the canary and then the beta. Yep. So you get some feedback that way. Also, sometimes something isn't noticed until later. And then browsers generally also have the ability to quickly roll out bug fixes if needed, but hopefully it doesn't come to that. In general, we just try to avoid patterns that risk backwards compatibility breakage. Oh. Almost all of the time, that doesn't impede development of the language.
Yeah. Was there ever an instance where you think, okay, we should have risk backwards compatibility for a higher purpose in some way?
So there are a couple compatibility risking changes that people are discussing right now in JavaScript. One is when you have a frozen object, adding private fields to the instance after it's been frozen, we're thinking of prohibiting that.
Yeah.
Where it's currently allowed.
I didn't know that.
And so that is sort of technically breaking in the sense of like Semver or whatever. We can't really apply Semver for JavaScript because you don't choose which version of it that you're using. But we suspect, and we're collecting some data on this, that people don't really write to frozen objects in that way often enough in practice. And so although it's kind of an observable change in behavior, we don't expect it to be breaking in practice. This is why we talk about don't break the web, where break the web means vaguely it's breaking enough, it's breaking badly enough.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing where the goal would be to prove that it's web compatible and then ship the change in the language.
Yeah, that makes sense. You brought up browsers in that scenario. Mm-hmm. How is the interaction between browser vendors, the TC39, because those are somewhat different, I would assume, but also somewhat not?
For a long time now, all JavaScript engine teams from browsers have had representation in TC39.
Okay.
I think back in the ES6, ES2015 days, in the development of that, there was a little bit of a disconnect between the people who the browsers were sending to TC39 and their actual engine implementers.
Okay.
So we ended up standardizing a bunch of things that, in retrospect, seem a little bit ill-considered. One of these is symbol species. Mm-hmm. Anyway, some things around subclassing, built-in classes, we kind of regret a little bit. At this point, all the browsers have really improved their representation and had more of a dialogue where they can collect feedback from their coworkers and bring it to committee about any possible implementation difficulties. So I think we've established a very good working relationship. It's complicated because, you know, they hold us to a high standard in terms of making sure that features are well-designed, well-motivated.
Right.
But those are good things. We should be not adding things to the language that are not useful.
Yes.
So sometimes browsers bring new proposed designs, or sometimes they just review other designs. Yeah, it's the TC39 consists of people from all these different backgrounds, JavaScript developers, academics, the theorists, and implementers.
That's where I was going with my next question, because like developing with a language and developing the language are two very fundamentally different things.
Yeah.
Like, I can absolutely write some JavaScript code, but I don't feel comfortable specifying how JavaScript is supposed to work. But if you say you have also academics on that, I assume like professors or something that are like very familiar with language design and those kind of things and add their expertise.
Yeah. I mean, there's also people who are kind of working in industry, but operating from a more, you know, formal methods perspective. We also have people who are maintaining important, you know, big web properties or tools or frameworks.
Right.
And they all offer, you know, complementary important perspectives.
But like those kind of industry experts, you invite on a proposal to proposal basis, or how does that work?
Well, we don't actually invite people kind of per proposal.
Okay.
So first, most of the work actually happens on GitHub, where anyone can participate without respect to who's a member or not. Mm-hmm. You know, we have various different repositories. You can see them listed from, you know, TC39/proposals in GitHub.
Yep.
And so each one of the things we're working on has a repository. There are issues. You can make pull requests. It's great to talk about your use cases.
And right.
That's always very useful input. But then we also have our meetings. So six times a year, we have a meeting for 3 or 4 days. And yeah, they're okay. About, I mean, it's like 15 or 16 hours of meeting time because we have breaks and such.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, we meet in person for 3 days, like in a particular place, mm-hmm. changing location, and then the other three are remote. But it's all kind of hybrid. Anyway, if you want to join those meetings, you're either supposed to be an invited expert mm-hmm. or a member. So invited experts are, for example, for the Babel project, members tend to be, they are legal entities, companies or universities or their nonprofits. The Babel project doesn't have a legal entity attached to it. It's not part of the OpenJS Foundation.
No.
So we decided to, in order to enable Babel's participation, create an invited expert status so that strategic, relevant open source projects can have representation in committee. We also, you know, have the typical membership process where for nonprofits and universities, there's no membership fee. For companies, there's a fee based on the company size. And that goes to pay for ECMA staff, which helps with things like note-taking and tooling to build the standard. You know, cool. There are actual costs associated with it, even though it's a little bit unfortunate. But generally, when someone has something to add and they want to participate, we work through it and we find a way to enable that. I don't think the membership process has been excluding people, but that said, if you're interested in participating, please reach out. I'd be happy to be in touch. You know, I'm kind of president of the ECMA Association, so I can help work through any issues. Depending on what you want to do, there are various different paths. So, you know, lots of different ways to contribute.
That's actually a really good point for my next question. So what would be reasons for companies to join the ECMA Foundation as a member? Like, ignoring the fee aspect of it, but why would I as a company decide, oh, I think this is a good idea for me to contribute in that sense?
Many companies make a lot of use of JavaScript.
I've heard that.
JavaScript is, if you compare it to most programming languages, pretty incomplete, pretty, you know, small standard library, missing a lot of features that basically all the other modern programming languages have. Yeah. And so this is a possible investment in improving your kind of developer productivity for your organization. That's why we in Bloomberg participate. We have our Bloomberg Terminal product, mm-hmm. and that's this desktop application for finance professionals, and the front end is all web-based. It's all based on Chromium, so it's all JavaScript, and we want to improve developers' ability to write such things, so we're working on modernizing the platform itself rather than building, you know, our own thing that would be obsolete within short time.
I love that way of thinking. On the other hand, though, you have the TS Blank Space project as well, which...
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's kind of like the TypeScript compiler, but in fast, or
right?
Faster.
So TS Blank Space is this project that my coworker Ashley Claymore in Bloomberg created, which is kind of a transpiler from TypeScript to JavaScript mm-hmm. that just replaces all the types with spaces. And what that means is that you don't really need source maps. It's always going to point to the right place because the offsets are just completely the same. So that can help with debugging. It also makes it faster to compile. It's kind of, depending how you slice it, you could consider it the fastest type stripper or one of the fastest. We created that initially for our own internal use. Mm-hmm. Actually, we've been using this strategy internally for a while, and eventually we did the work to open source it to kind of...
I didn't know that. That's very cool. How does it then compare to the new, fairly new experimental mode for Node.js to just strip the type information? It sounds like, from an approach perspective, very similar.
Right. Well, we participated in those discussion threads in Node.js and kind of seeded the idea of doing this blank space strategy. So actually SWC implemented it based on Ashley's suggestions before we even finished open sourcing our own TS blank space implementation.
So it's kind of the idea got spread, and then at the same time multiple implementation happened.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to just make our own weird thing. We want to be using
share the weird thing.
We want to be aligned with the ecosystem, and sometimes that means going out and learning about what the rest of the ecosystem is doing, and sometimes it helps to nudge in a particular direction. So I think a lot of companies, if they thought it through and thought in terms of a 2-year time horizon instead of like a quarter, they would realize that they would get a lot of benefit from participating in the upstream JavaScript community. Yeah. Just in terms of their own productivity, just measured narrowly like that. It doesn't have to be thought of as a charitable act.
Yeah.
So one important enabling thing about TS Blank Space is that it's based on our understanding of what we call modern TypeScript, where you use TypeScript just for the types.
Yes.
Which is where it really shines, where it gives this extra functionality. There are a couple of features that TypeScript has that aren't compatible with TS Blank Space, where they actually do a little bit of runtime behavior.
Yeah.
But we find that there are kind of various other ways to deal with them. I guess enums stand out as a difficult case, but we're working with the TypeScript team on...
I think string literal types are very viable.
Right. I mean, there are a few different approaches. You do. Right. It is useful to have this kind of namespace object that maps the names to the things, and it's useful to have kind of a hidden brand associated with the enum type.
That's true.
So we're working on kind of recovering that. But there are a bunch of strategies of dealing with it without that.
So you just said also that you're working with the TypeScript team on that.
Yeah.
How is the collaboration between TC39 and TypeScript? Because there's also a proposal for Type Commons that I think is heavily pushed by the TypeScript team.
Right. So TypeScript has been involved in TC39 for many years. I don't know, at least since 2014, but maybe further back. I mean, not that much further back, because that was soon after it was released.
Okay.
And longer than I've been, because I only got involved in the committee in 2015 or so.
Okay.
So TypeScript is a very important implementation of JavaScript. And all new changes to TypeScript have been just in the type space, not in adding any of these features that we would call kind of outside of modern TypeScript. So they've been very good partners on a number of different features. For example, they got frequent requests for the question mark dot operator, optional chaining. Yep. And people were saying, oh, TC39 is so slow, they won't do it. Maybe you should just add it to TypeScript. And the TypeScript team, instead of doing that, they worked with TC39 to push the proposal through, where it wasn't actually that TC39 had rejected it or anything. It was more that we were still having certain discussions. They were taking some time. But then people got tired of it, and they stopped talking about it for 2 years. And so
I can see that.
This is what I mean by, like, a lot of times things aren't moving forward because people are even disagreeing actively. Sometimes just nobody puts in the work, kind of the product management kind of work to push something forward and to work through whatever disagreements. So the TypeScript team did that and got it into the language pretty quickly after they got involved.
Cool.
And I think that's a really good model. They were also involved. I was working with them way back in on class fields, like figuring out how to evolve those from what TypeScript has always had to what we have now with private fields as well as public fields.
Yeah. Other than like optional chaining operator, how involved are you, or how collaborative is it with like new proposals around signals, for instance? I know there are like a couple of requests to mark functions as pure, so that you, and this is like more of a TypeScript only feature, I feel like, where you basically, to prevent like the additional type guards that you would need because you're, it's a function call.
Well,
it's kind of blurry.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting at a lot of different interesting areas, and I want to come back to the type annotations proposal as well.
Oh, yeah.
But about pure functions, there have been suggestions to define kind of pure functions in particular, for example, so that if the module at the top level is pure, then you can kind of load it lazily and it won't have any side effects.
Right.
For that particular module case, what we've decided to do is add this feature called import defer, which is at stage 3.
Yeah.
And it makes it so that if on your on the importing side, you import it as a namespace, so like import star as namespace from whatever, but you do import defer star, then it won't actually run the top-level statements of the module until you actually access a property of it.
Oh, that's cool.
And we found that that saves a lot of time in loading in practice. It's been implemented in Webpack, and I'm not sure if it's landed, but at least it's out for review in Safari, in JavaScript Core.
That's very cool.
By Egalia. That was a project that we sponsored Egalia to implement. So that's one dimension of purity. But another dimension of purity is, like you mentioned, with signals, or in general, even with React, when you have one-way data flow, you want to have your model that you calculate out into your view. Yep. I guess maybe people think of those words as outdated, you know, a model view controller that's like old UI stuff, but I think it still makes sense as a way to think about this. You have your state, your centralized state management. I guess maybe people are saying that's outdated as well. I think it's still when you React query, that kind of thing is implementing, you know, centralized state management. Right. At least part of it. Routers as well are kind of a centralized place to put state. You want your UI to be driven by stuff like the route and the, you know, cache query results, and for it to be just kind of a function of that. Mm-hmm. Ideally a pure function, though what pure means is a little bit ambiguous, or a little bit subtle. It's not ambiguous. You want it to be that if you run it again, it'll get the same answer, for example. You want it to be that it won't make the wrong kind of change to the outside world, or that it won't save state in some way that's kind of hidden from the global mechanisms. I haven't heard of a proposal for putting this into TypeScript. It would be an interesting idea, but
There are a couple like GitHub repositories if I remember correctly, and if I remember during editing, I might put the link in the show notes. I think there's a proposal from Josh Goldberg, the maintainer from TypeScript ESLint, to basically mark a function as pure, so that when you access a signal property, you don't need to do like additional type checking again for like if you have like the signal has a value or undefined. With the way it's right now, every time you call the signal, you lose the type checking of it might be undefined.
Okay. So that's like a third thing. So
kind of.
TypeScript has this thing where if called like type narrowing, that you know, Josh is obviously fully aware of that.
Oh, Josh is great for
figuring
all that out.
And it's great that Josh is now in DC39 as an invited expert you know, because obviously TS-Lint is a pretty important project, and he has great insights about the ecosystem due to his work on that project. Nicolo Ribaudo of the Babel project, also an Egalia employee, has been recruiting various people in the tool space to give input on TC39 matters, and I think that's been a really good effort.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So type narrowing is where you have a conditional and you say, like, if you know something that implies that an assertion is true, that something is of a particular type, then inside that branch, it will then type as that value. But this works for variables. It also works for properties. Even if it's a getter setter, it will still, you know, TypeScript will kind of ignore that and say, well, probably the property will have the same type as, because, you know, you probably design your class in a way that that's consistent. But it doesn't work with function calls. So with the signals proposal, we have our .get and .set methods. No. We could change it to getter setter, like .value thing. Maybe we should, but there are certain subclassing related reasons why we thought it would be more convenient to separate methods. Anyway, the problem is that TypeScript doesn't associate that together, neither with .get or .set, nor with the solid style. You just call it as a function,
right?
Because it doesn't have any particular understanding that that function is special or different. So this is the kind of thing that would be resolved just at the TypeScript level.
Okay.
And honestly, I can empathize with the TypeScript team for not having done something in this area yet, because it's very specialized.
Yes.
And a good thing about TypeScript is that it allows itself to be unsound. It allows itself to just kind of take decisions that seem practical. They might result in type check errors that aren't completely necessary. They might result in not having a type check error in something that will break at runtime. But neither of those are fatal, because JavaScript already has its type information at runtime.
Right.
So that gives it a lot of flexibility for evolution in the future. That's one reason why it wouldn't make sense to standardize TypeScript's type checking in JavaScript.
Yeah.
In the standard.
Okay. Now that you say it, I think this is a great point to circle back to the type annotation proposal.
Right. Yeah. So for that proposal, we were initially calling it types as comments, because
right.
the idea was that the types are erased. They don't have any semantics at runtime. They might as well be comments.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was intelligible to some people more than others. It was a little bit mixed. Because are you saying that it should use comment syntax? No, the goal is that we would allow TypeScript syntax actually to be used in JavaScript.
No.
I was kind of working with TypeScript actively with others on that proposal, and it's still at stage one, but it's not clear whether it will go forward in its current form.
Okay.
So what we need somehow is to standardize something that matches basically what TypeScript already has, because it is the kind of ecosystem standard for type syntax as well as type semantics. The semantics shouldn't be part of anything that's shared, because it hasn't yet been demonstrated that anybody except for the original TypeScript team can build a second type checker.
Right.
But at the same time, the syntax has to be implemented by a lot of different tools. So just standardizing the syntax of like which are the things that are types that should be ignored and stripped out would be really useful, even if it ends up being only a tools thing and not part of what browsers implement.
Wouldn't having, as far as I know, JS doc is more of a mutual agreement than an official specification, but wouldn't that solve that issue, basically just standardizing JS doc properly, because it's already widely accepted?
Well, JS doc's already there. I don't think maybe standardizing it could be useful for the family of tools that implement JS doc to help them coordinate better. But all of the JavaScript build tools already know to ignore all comments. Those are comments. So for that family of things, there isn't really a problem to be solved standardizing it.
I see what you're saying.
Anyway, JS doc is a lot more unergonomic than using TypeScript syntax.
That's very true.
It's also limited in features. That part is addressable. Like, they recently added import statements in JS doc, TypeScript did. And they could keep adding more stuff, but it will still be more awkward, especially when you have to do stuff with types kind of in the middle of a nested expression, you know, like those exclamation point assertions for non-null. It would be difficult to be switching in and out of comments. And so you end up today having to make other intermediate variables. Anyway, I think just TypeScript is a well-designed syntax. It's a little bit complicated, but I think we can manage it. It's been demonstrated that people can manage it. And I don't want to give everybody a worse developer experience just for the sake of kind of purity that it only should be comments.
I personally think that TypeScript is very, very reasonable for applications. Like, writing types for applications is pretty straightforward. as you wanted. For libraries, it can be very complex very, very quickly.
Oh, really? Like in which way?
Like if thinking? I just look at the RxJS types, some of them are just banana.
Yeah, but I feel like that's a strength. Like it allows library authors to make these complicated types that do useful and detailed type checking logic.
And that's the thing. I don't think this is really a TypeScript issue. It's more like JavaScript allows for very weird things, and TypeScript found a way to represent all those things somewhat cohesive.
But JavaScript isn't so unusual in this regard. If you look at C++ templates, they're also very complicated and getting more complicated over time. There are important kinds of metaprogramming that you want to be able to represent in the type system. You can have the type system just say, well, I don't know what's going on. It's just any. Or you can have kind of a macro system C++ templates is in some way. Yeah. And then the type checking just kind of happens after macro expansion. But the macro implementations are still complicated. And the type errors that you get are then a little bit difficult to read because they're with respect to that whole system.
That's true.
So I think TypeScript, it's good that it gives library authors these advanced tools.
Yes.
Yeah, within Bloomberg's internal use of JavaScript, we have some pretty fancy types.
I can imagine.
Or like build pipelines that generate type declarations. Just for certain internal APIs that we have to make them more kind of ergonomic and well-typed at the same time.
So that is actually one thing that I also wanted to ask you about, like from a creative aspect. Your day-to-day job is doing work for Bloomberg primarily. So is it that you sit there and be like, okay, this is something that we could solve more elegantly if we would have a feature in JavaScript, or is it more vice versa? There's a proposal in JavaScript and you see like, oh, this would be really nice for Bloomberg. I could apply this in these instances. Maybe there might be a way for me to support this. Like from a creative aspect, how's that going?
It's very case by case. You know, each feature is very different from each other.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's that we have something internally that seems like it would be useful generally. So I mentioned TS Blank Space. Import Defer is another example because we've for a long time in one of our module systems have had a sort of implementation of this. Mm-hmm. The more recently we've been investing in and optimizing it, just important for terminal startup performance.
Yeah.
And diverging from the rest of the ecosystem then is costly over time as we do more. So that was part of our motivation for that. Yeah. Other proposals like Temporal, which we've been working on as well, we use a lot of dates and times. And anything you do with dates and times in JavaScript is a little bit less trustworthy because of the many mistakes you can make with dates.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, a lot of the calculation should be more on the back end.
Yes.
But even then, we have a lot of back end JavaScript as well. So making sure that we have a data type that represents that with less potential for bugs is something that we predict will be useful for us.
Yeah.
And it kind of, so it can go in both directions.
Speaking of the temporal proposal though, I'm kind of curious how that happened because I imagine like if someone from a community aspect, it's very known that dates are a challenging problem in JavaScript and that the current solution are not a great fit. But like from a browser vendor perspective, I would be like, more thinking of like, okay, we already have a date API, why do we need a second date API? And what prevents us from having a third, fourth, and fifth?
I think browsers have been very constructive in the development of the temporal mm-hmm. API. Andre Bargul at Mozilla has been, you know, over the years implementing it in SpiderMonkey and in Firefox.
Right.
And so that is, at least, it's been shipping in nightly. I think it's going to go to,
probably
by the time this podcast is released, it'll be out in, Firefox by default.
Awesome.
So they've been giving a lot of really helpful feedback. I think dates and times are the kind of thing that it's not just a trend thing. There's like a lot of things to solve to make it work, and then you solve them, and then that's it. I don't think we're going to keep having more. I think signals is kind of the same. It's maybe too easy for me to make this claim, but if you look into the problem, then you can... And you look at what other libraries have done, you can see it really is just kind of converging on one particular thing.
True.
It's not always just random waves in the wind. So that's the kind of thing that we have to prove out, you know, on a case-by-case basis, that it does actually make sense, that it's not a passing fad or something.
Makes sense.
I think people have enough experience in day-to-day programming that they end up needing dates or times. And so it doesn't end up being that hard to prove. With decimal, I think that's also a very common case, and also one where there is a good solution that we could just make default. But it's been a little bit harder to explain because it comes up in some applications more than others.
Yeah. One thing that I'm always wondered by, because there is an observable proposal that is in stage two, I think, for at least 5 years. But now there's also a WICG proposal that moves forward. So how are those committees different, and how do they collaborate or not? And that feels like a little bit arbitrary for me in a way.
Yeah, I think it is arbitrary. At some point, the standards venues are just kind of in competition with each other for who can be the most accommodating and productive place to do work.
Yeah.
And sometimes we don't present ourselves well enough as TC39 to be the encouraging place. In the case of observables, you know, they were last discussed in, I think there was some discussion in 2018, but the last time that they were really intensively worked on over time was in 2016.
Yeah.
And just nobody brought them back to committee. Maybe we seemed too unfriendly. So we've invited the author of the WICG observables proposal to come present to TC39. It hasn't worked out yet.
Gotcha.
I think for a lot of these things that really are just pure logic, it would make sense to put it in JavaScript, but also it's okay to make it not part of JavaScript. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Personally, I pushed back on observables in 2016 because they hadn't worked out their integration with the web platform.
Yeah.
Now they have, so they've solved that technical problem that I raised. Yeah. But it's possible that in retrospect, people were taking that kind of pushback as, oh, TC39 is unfriendly to this proposal, which is not really what I intended.
I don't think that's the case. So just like recalling from my memory, because I think we briefly talked about it 2018, 2019. And for us, the processes were just very intransparent. So maybe we should have pushed a little bit harder, but it felt kind of like we didn't quite know what's missing from our side of that.
Right.
And I don't mean this in any critical way or anything.
Yeah, I mean, trying to remember, like, I had DMs with a couple of people from the Angular team. Yeah, probably
I'm
you.
From the Angular team, but I was.
Yeah, you DM'd me about this, and we were going to follow up, and then we just didn't.
So the thing that we discussed was basically that one issue was that the RxJS API surface is massively huge, and people on the TC39 were somewhat intimidated by just copying that, which was never our intent. So,
So no one ever tried to bring the current observable proposal to TC39.
Okay.
We haven't rejected it, and I was trying to encourage you at that time when I don't know if it was 2019 or 2017,
something like that
we were DMing about it. But I don't know. I wish we had followed up more, because I think we could work through these things. One thing that I'm concerned about with observables is, actually, this was part of what inspired me to work on signals. I don't want them to be understood as the web platform's like native encouraged way to do reactivity, because
I agree.
They are a broken way to do reactivity. They're push based. They don't.
Broken is a very strong word.
In general, they stand for an event stream, which is great.
Yes.
They don't stand for like a cell that contains a current value.
Yes.
And that seems to be what people are reaching for a lot of the time when they use observables.
I say this very often. I think observables is one of those things that is over and underused at the same time, where like people use it for the wrong contexts way too often.
Yeah.
And therefore get like burned out on them, where it's like, yes, it's a primitive, so you can do a lot of stuff with it. That doesn't mean you should do a lot of stuff with them.
Yeah, in particular, signals do a better job representing the current value 100%. In that they're kind of, auto-tracking helps a lot. You don't have to piece together the pipelines and join them and everything. You just access the signal. Right. The other thing is that they are glitch-free and that you're always getting a consistent, when you have a calculation that's based on a signal, you're always getting a consistent view of the whole set of values, whereas if you try to do the same thing with observables, you'll Yes. You'll run into a mix of old and new things. Yes. And so, yeah, I really don't want people to fall down that bad path. And yes. if I, you know, that's part of my skepticism for observables, but as we're working on them both in parallel, I think it can be okay. Right. I really hope the, you know, documentation in MDN or, yes. you know, Chrome's outreach, whatever, explains this clearly.
Yeah. But that, sorry, just for my understanding, that basically means that the WICG is more driven by the browsers and they'll just implement it based on the specification, and TC39 is really driving the JavaScript specification as a language. Is that a fair statement? Or is it...
There are definitely people who will say it's unfair.
Okay.
I've made a WICG proposal, but it is a process that anyone can go and participate in. Mm-hmm. But, well, first of all, WICG itself is not a standards committee.
Okay.
It is a place that you can kind of deposit ideas mm-hmm. that have interest from multiple parties and collaborate on them with intellectual property protection. So I mentioned that with TC39, we have a CLA. Mm-hmm. It's like a slightly stretching the truth, because it's not stretching the truth. It's just subtly different from a CLA. Yeah. We try to have even stronger guarantees about intellectual property when it comes to standards, because we really don't want anyone to come back and claim, oh, I have a patent over this part of the standard. Yeah. You know, it feels unlikely in this kind of open source space, but in networking and multimedia standards, it happens all the time that people claim patents.
Yes.
So we really do our best to keep it out. Anyway, WICG has, like TC39, structures for this, mm-hmm. but they don't have the structures of a standards committee. They're a place that you can make a repository, you can discuss things however you want. There are some meetings to, like, some structures to help people collect feedback more openly. Mm-hmm. But the strong position of Mozilla and Apple has been that these things eventually need to be brought to working groups. They need to be brought to, you know, a group of people who will own and maintain the standard.
Gotcha.
And not just kind of shipped from WICG and then that's it.
Gotcha.
You know, WICG cannot publish standards. Yeah. They end up being transferred to other places, either working groups or one of those is like WG?
Yes.
The place where HTML is standardized.
Okay.
So yeah, they all have processes for determining consensus, determining whether something has enough buy-in mm-hmm. from various parties. And but at the same time, browsers can ship whatever they want. Browsers are not restricted to ship standards.
It's their product at the end of the day.
It's their product. Ultimately, we're all kind of depending on the rest of the standards world providing enough value to help in the technical development of these things to pay for ourselves, our involvement. Yeah. And I think we've seen a lot of support from all three browsers in having these standards bodies exist and getting them resourced in promoting these open technical discussions. But people also get frustrated that things are taking time and they take shortcuts in kind of this community building. Or they say, you know, I've already talked to the real community. Maybe I don't need to talk to this standards body of people who are just kind of theorists or stop energy or things like that.
Right.
So it's kind of a constant discussion about how we can make sure that we're being constructive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that totally makes sense. I think we're slowly good to come to an end here. One thing that I'm very curious though to ask you, if there's one proposal that where you're like, this is what JavaScript really needs right now, like that you would, like if you could push to stage four right now and be happy. I know this is not how this works, but like, is there one proposal like that that you feel really, really passionate about?
Oh, there's a bunch of them.
One
that I would mention that kind of isn't moving forward right now, but mm-hmm. really should, is module declarations and module expressions. These let you make ES modules, but multiple modules within the same file. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, right now to ship JavaScript, you can use ESM. You can use ES modules to like bundle your whole website and put it in a big ES module.
Right.
But within that, the bundler will have to implement a CJS loader, which is really kind of silly and means that we're still not fully aligned on semantics, because in some edge cases they behave differently.
Yeah.
I think it would be great if we could actually ship ES modules fully and the main missing feature, there are others to support, you know, hot module reloading and such, but the biggest missing feature is just the fact that on the web, each time you import a module is a separate network request.
Yes.
So you get a terrible waterfall effect.
Yes.
And you really just want to be able to put several different modules in one file. I've looked into, you know, web bundles as a potential solution, this kind of general bundling format, but even that still kind of simulates HTTP calls and will just be too expensive for normal websites. So I think it would be great if we could get this native JavaScript bundle format added. We have a very good proposal written by Niccolo Ribaudo, who I mentioned before, for both module expressions, which is just if you have an anonymous module that maybe you'll pass into a function, for example, to start a worker but running some code so that it can all be bundled together without using like a data URL that requires that you have, you know, weaker CSP settings or things like that. And the other is module declarations that lets you do this actual bundling thing where you have several different modules that are bound to particular variables that you can import at runtime, you know, including in static import statements, you know, the import declarations. So I really want that one to go through. And we actually have like a smaller working group within TC39, which we call the Harmony working group, because that somehow stands for ES6 and modules. Anyway, we have an extra chat room on Matrix you could join, and regular meetings that are open to anybody who wants to join, not just restricted to TC39 members. This would be potentially a great place to contribute, and I would really wish that it could get standardized.
Yes, sir. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate all the work you put into that. I can just fathom how many hours on a weekly basis you invest into that. So thank you very much for the work. And also thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a great conversation.
Anytime.